Hello and welcome to the Sewers of Paris. We're on a search for entertainment that changed the lives of gay men. Join us on tonight's episode when my guest Ira Madison recalls some youthful mischief.
I remember trying to, fix a school election once.
The topic is soap operas, James Baldwin, and Angels in America. Why is villainy so much fun? Whether it's a cackling Emperor Palpatine or Joan Collins smirking smugly on Dynasty, bad guys invariably seem to be having such a good time, and it can be hard to resist wanting to join them. My guest this week is Ira Madison, culture writer for The Daily Beast and co-host of the Keep It podcast. As a kid, he was quick to notice that the most fun part of his favorite soap operas were the over-the-top scene-chewing scoundrels, and during his time as a playwright in New York, he strove to give audiences experiences that were just as entertaining. Now, as a culture critic, he's approaching storytelling from the other side, searching for the most entertaining aspects of other creators' work. By the way, the next Sewers of Paris livestream is coming up. Join us on Saturday, April 14th, for another live chat with me and other Sewers listeners. The theme this time is animation. I can't wait to geek out with you about Steven Universe, Korra, and Bugs Bunny's drag career. Head over to the Sewers of Paris Twitter feed. There's a pinned tweet with a link to the livestream. We go live on Saturday, April 14th at 2 p.m. Pacific. Thanks to everyone who makes the Sewers of Paris possible with a pledge of a dollar or more a month on Patreon. There are special rewards for patrons like early ad-free access to content, shoutouts and videos, and a copy of my book mailed to you with some cute Sewers of Paris buttons. If you're enjoying the show, head over to sewersofparis.com and click support the show on Patreon. Or if you can't pledge, you can still help out by leaving a review on your podcast platform of choice. And remember, you can find clips of the entertainment that we talked about in this week's episode at sewersofparis.com. Now, here's Ira. Well, this week I'm speaking to Ira Madison, writer at Daily Beast and host of Keep It. Ira, thanks so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
So, what is the entertainment that changed your life?
It was probably daytime television, weirdly enough. As a kid, I started watching soap operas because of my family, and that sort of led me to eventually watching them on my own, and NBC's ridiculous lineup of Days of Our Lives and Passions sort of led me, I feel like, into wanting to write, into, you know, my enjoyment of television and theatric melodrama. I got into theater as well. So I would probably say both of those shows.
How old were you when you started watching?
I was probably in middle school.
And how did, like, I can't imagine the other kids were like, oh, you got to see Passions this week. Like, how did it come up that this was a part of your life?
Days of Our Lives, no. But Passions was definitely a big thing that kids watched, especially in my age group.
Really?
It aired right when we would be getting out of school. I mean, and it was teenagers, and it was Supernatural, and it was zombies and witches and talking dolls, and it was definitely a big teen show, especially in the summer. I have lots of friends who I've met now in Los Angeles who talk about having watched Passions when they were growing up.
This week on Passions, just when they thought it was safe.
What is that?
What is that?
What was that?
A tsunami strikes with a new vengeance.
Run!
Lives will be changed when the Passions disaster strikes again. NBC Daytime.
So what was it just like the it sounds like dark fantasy of it that you found gripping?
I found the dark fantasy of it gripping. I found the characters gripping. I was, you know, pulled into the romance and the mystery and the supernatural bit of it. Just all of it was sort of very appealing to all of my senses. Because before that, I had been really into reading, you know, like Christopher Pike novels as a kid, or like the Fear Street saga by R.L. Stein. So I was into like pulpy paperback teen novels, and here was a TV show that sort of blew up all of that and gave it to you every day as a television show.
Were there particular storylines that you were really into?
I was really into a girl named Kay who was in love with her cousin's boyfriend. So she replaced her cousin with a zombie who sort of did her bidding. That led to somehow there being a closet that led to hell. which tried to sink the house into hell.
Daddy! Is it really you?
Yes, Miguel! Hurry! You're my only hope!
Miguel's a goner for sure. The demons will get him before he can rescue Charity. And then evil will reign in harmony with me as its queen.
There was a character named Sheridan who was best friends with Princess Diana. And when Princess Diana died in real life, she was afraid that she was going to die like Princess Diana. And she kept ending up in weird scenarios where she would die like Diana. Like, she almost died in a tunnel due to paparazzi. It was crazy and crass and kind of awful to air on TV, but I guess that was part of the appeal of it.
This sounds like it's kind of daytime soap opera Buffy. Is that a fair way to think of it?
I guess, except it was way beyond Buffy. It was, you know, it was...
Way beyond Buffy,
it,
now,
it was, over the top. Buffy was a quality TV show.
Okay.
Passions was definitely not written to be a good show. It was written to just be entertaining.
So, like, you mentioned the, pulpy paperback novels that you like. So it sounds like somebody found a way to translate this onto the screen.
Yes.
So you had that, and then you had Days of Our Lives, which is like a super traditional, like going back hundreds of years soap opera, right?
Yeah, it debuted in the, well, not that long, but it debuted in 1964, so it's been on for quite some time.
And I think you said that that was something that you watched with your family?
Yes, that was something that I watched with my family, but the creator of Passions left Days of Our Lives to create Passions. So he was a head writer on Days of Our Lives for a period in the 90s. And that was when Days of Our Lives switched from more of a traditional soap opera like the other ones on air and had, you know, demonic possessions and people being buried alive.
That must have been controversial for soap opera fans.
It was a bit, but the demonic possession storyline actually happened the summer after the O.J. Simpson trial ended. The trial sort of ruined daytime television ratings because, you know, shows weren't airing when they were supposed to be, and everyone was glued to their TV waiting for the verdict and watching the trial. And when it ended, soap operas had a hard time sort of recovering and getting people to watch them again. And so the head writer, James E. Reilly, cooked up this demonic possession storyline for Days, and it was one of the only shows in the aftermath of the Simpson trial whose ratings actually started rising because people had to tune in for this ridiculous storyline.
So you had your friends who were watching Passions and your family who was watching Days of Our Lives. Did you have different ways of talking about soap operas with these two different groups?
The way that kids would talk about, you know, the soap opera Passions was sort of similar to the way that I would talk about it with my parents. And they've since moved on to, they mostly watch other shows now, like Young and the Restless or something. I think my grandmother still watches that. And when I was at home over Christmas, you know, my family members are still talking about those characters and their relationships. And they tended to be more, you know, caring about the traditional relationship drama on the shows. Whereas my friends, when we talk about Passions, or remember when Passions was on the air, or when we would talk about it back in the day, we were always obsessed with the crazy stuff that was happening on it. You know, the less focus on who was dating who on the show, etc.
I guess when you're watching something that's about zombies, you really want to focus on the zombies.
Yes.
So was there, I know soap operas have had a mixed record on this. Was there queer content on either of these shows?
There was not really on Days of Our Lives, although there is currently, but Passions had sort of a big queer fan base, partly because it was just so campy and offbeat, but there were also characters there was a character, Chad, who ended up being gay on the show. Sorry, there was a girl, Simone, who was a lesbian. And there was a transsexual character on the show as well. That was in later seasons. But it sort of had that queer element in it from time to time, even though they were horribly handled. It still felt sort of fun to watch.
What was horrible about how they were handled?
One character who was transsexual was the person who was apparently shifting between being a man and a woman on the show and blackmailing people and also being a murderer, and I believe slept with their dad at one point. The gay character was having an affair when we found out that he was gay, but the person he was cheating on was actually his sister. They were dating and did not know they were related. The lesbian character didn't really do much, but I do remember her girlfriend being murdered by a serial killer.
These are very soap opera plots that you're describing. So with these characters, was there any part of you that was like, oh, I see a little of myself in them? Or was it just too bizarre and out there for you to like identify with these other queer characters?
It was too bizarre to sort of identify with the queer characters, I feel like. And I actually didn't find myself really identifying with queer characters in cinema or writing probably until my college years, to be honest. I mean, in college, I think I remember finally watching all of Queer as Folk and watching the series Noah's Ark via Netflix, finally diving into and watching like some of the L Word, watching things like that, and finally reading James Baldwin and other sort of queer literature. But I feel like in, you know, my younger years, I was just drawn to, you know, like the sort of crazy villainouses on soap operas, you know, and the way that gays have, you know, campy sort of female icons that they've grown up with. I felt like those were the characters that I identified with on the show the most.
Yeah. So tell me about the campy villainouses, because I can't resist those.
There was Sammy Brady, who was the sort of bad girl who, when she was young, caught her mom having an affair, so it sort of affected the rest of her life, and she just became sort of a petty bitch throughout her entire life. She switched DNA results for a pregnancy that she had. She faked amnesia once. She routinely would scheme to get a guy to marry her, and she would make it to the altar, but the wedding would always get ruined when her secrets would come out. She once put on a mask and became a man for an entire summer and was blackmailed. Yeah, she wore a mask that made her look like a man. She became Stan for an entire summer and was,
oh my God,
ruining people's lives. The person who played Stan actually was I forget his name, but that actor was a contestant on, I don't know if you remember that old gay dating show, Boy Meets Boy.
Sort of.
The Boy Meets Boy was 2000s, and that was a show where I believe a gay guy was, there were a bunch of people that he was supposed to date, but half of the men were straight guys pretending to be gay.
Oh, yes, I do. Yeah.
So he had to make sure he picked a gay guy to win, you know.
Right. And it was all like, oh yeah, I remember like the game of it was like the straight guys like having to pretend to be gay for the money.
Yeah.
Wasn't that it? Okay. Yeah. I remember that being a really problematic premise.
In the end, he must select just one man.
Will you stay?
I would love to.
But appearances aren't always what they seem.
You assumed I was gay. Why?
What neither the gay suitors nor the leading man know is that some of the suitors are straight men pretending to be gay.
I love you.
Competing to win a cash prize. Will the leading man discover their secret?
So he was a contestant. This guy who played Stan was a contestant. Was he gay or was he one of the straight men?
He was one of the straight men, but he then later became an actor. Or I feel like that was his only acting role. But, you know, that was Sammy. There was Vivian, a woman who buried her rival alive and put a transmitter radio in the coffin so that she could taunt her while she was buried alive.
Oh my God.
There was Kate, you know, who sent Sammy to death row after Kate's son killed Sammy's fiance with a gun. They set up Sammy to go to death row. The best, of course, was Kristen DiMera, who was played by Eileen Davidson, who was recently a Real Housewife of Beverly Hills. She was the villainess who was a very nice person when she started on the show in the 90s, but the man she was with went back to the woman he was in love with. She lost the baby that they had, and so she faked the pregnancy, stole another woman's baby, kept her rival locked up in a wine cellar in their basement, and she also played like 5 different roles on the show. So, you know, it was a fun, wacky character that she had.
Yeah, these villains keep really busy.
And so these were the people that I was drawn to, you know? It's when you see, you know, like, the villain plotting their scheme, and it, you know, it takes months for it to unfold, and you're just sort of following them as they, you know, try to work through it every day, or like the, you know, the successes and the failures they have with it. It became really engrossing to me as a kid, I guess.
Did you have like villainous schemes as a child?
Probably, you know, I felt like it affected I feel like every kid has like a bad behavior phase. And mine was probably more over the top than, you know, like what you would assume like a regular like middle school boy might have been, you know, just
because what way?
I remember trying to like fix a school election once.
What?
Just by like, you know, trying to like change the results of who won a school election once.
So I'm imagining you like having like the Watergate break-in or something in your middle school. Like how were you in a position to change the results, and why did you want to do that?
Because someone I did not like was running opposite me.
Ah, so what was your scheme?
Really just writing my own entries and swapping them in.
Okay, so you're ballot stuffing. Did you get caught?
I did not get caught, but I did not put enough in to win.
Oh no. What was the office that you were running for?
I think like student government or something.
Why did you want it enough that you were like doing these like literally like worthy of a soap opera schemes to win this election?
I've just always been very much into winning and being successful. And now I'm able to do it with talent.
Instead of cheating.
Yes.
What were the other like competitive things that you did back then?
I was in theater in high school, so you know, a lot of the competition came from, you know, trying to beat people for, you know, roles or positions. I was also read for the school paper, so you know, and I had like a gossip column. So
really, what was the like student gossip column like?
Not really a gossip column so much as it was sort of a precursor to Twitter. I feel like I had a column where I put every thought about the school and like pop culture, you know, just like bullet pointed, and it came in a column every issue.
Okay,
and
it's sort like, of
if
like
I look at it now, it would probably look like my Twitter feed.
It reminds me a bit of like Mateer and Ross and Herb Cain in San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
Were there any controversies? Like, I mean, like when you say gossip column, I imagine it like some sort of, I don't know, like blind items and stuff like that.
Yeah, no, it was really just like my opinion on like the school play, or like my opinion on what a teacher, you know, some new policy at school was.
Did this give you sort of a sense of authority in the school that like people were listening to your opinions?
It did, you know, which I felt like I craved a bit for my own, you know, vanity reasons. But, you know, I also went to an all-boys school and was one of, like, maybe 3 black students at the school, too, you know. So it was sort of a way to stand out in a way that made me feel in control, I guess.
Mm. Did you feel like you stood out for being black, that people were noticing you just, oh, there's the black guy?
Probably, you know. It's hard not to. when there's only two in a school.
So you mentioned that you were in drama club as well. Like, what kind of roles did you like to take on?
I actually was in, I think, like three musicals. But for the most part, I was doing, you know, behind the scenes work, and I flourished into playwriting. And I started doing my own plays about junior year of high school.
So you were writing sort of autobiographical plays?
No. I was just writing Neil Simon-ish comedies, I guess.
Okay.
I remember I wrote one about, like, a couple trying to murder someone. And I feel like I wrote another one about, like, a dinner party gone wrong. You know, I was reading a lot of, like I said, Neil Simon, Harold Pinter at the time. So I was probably, you know, as a teen trying to emulate those kinds of plays and characters.
Do you remember, like, having anything that you felt like you needed to get across, like things that you felt like needed to be said?
No, I felt like I wrote only to entertain at that point in my life.
So it was sort of like farces and stuff like that?
Yes.
And it does sound like, I mean, the couple, like, plotting to kill somebody does sound like you're certainly taking notes from the soap operas and novels you were reading.
Yeah, you know, I feel like they taught me, you know, at least how to write plot lines, how to write drama. And, you know, I was eventually, I continued in the playwriting in New York for a few years before I moved to Los Angeles.
What kind of plays did you do there?
There was when I was writing about things, you know, so I had a play about the Harlem Renaissance. You know, I had a play about black soldiers in the Vietnam War. I was more social conscious by the time I was in graduate school.
So, I mean, it's kind of a big deal to be able to go to New York. Like, where did you come from?
Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
I mean, not that Milwaukee's, like, nowhere, but, like, to go from doing high school plays in Milwaukee to staging shows in New York about the Harlem Renaissance sounds like quite a journey. Like, what got you from out west to the big city?
Well, I went to Loyola Chicago for undergraduate.
To study writing?
Well, just to do, our program was a BFA, so we had to, or was it a BA? Whichever one it was, we weren't just able to focus on theater, we had to take other classes as well. So there wasn't a specialized, you know, like, oh, I could focus on writing at Loyola. And I eventually did, like, was working on my own plays, and they actually started a playwriting course they happened to while I was there. So that was useful for me to keep writing. I think I produced a couple of plays and directed maybe a couple shorter plays when I was at Loyola, and then moved to New York in 2007.
What was your plan when you moved to New York?
I did not have a plan. I moved to New York for two summer classes at NYU. One of them was in television writing and the other was in comic book writing, because I was interested in learning more about both of those. And I just decided to stay in New York after those classes. I got an internship at Radar Magazine, and it led to me doing other interning, because, you know, that was the only way I felt like I could still be writing and living in the city. So, you know, it, like, led to internships then at, like, Page Six magazine and other places in New York, which eventually, of course, led me to my current career of, you know, being a culture writer at the Daily Beast, and having written for GQ and Vulture, New York Magazine, other places. So that's where the roots of that sort of began. But yeah, I just decided to stay in New York after I took those NYU classes and lived there for a few years. I lived there till 2011. I went to graduate school at NYU when I was there from 2009 to 2011. I got my MFA in dramatic writing, which consisted of playwriting and also screenwriting. And then I moved to Los Angeles, and I've been here almost 7 years now.
You mentioned that it was when you started going to college that you found queer literary figures that you could identify with. So who were you reading and who were you learning about? And like, did you have queer contemporaries that you liked as well?
Yeah, you know, I first started reading James Baldwin books when I was in college. I feel like I was introduced to a friend in, you know, like one of our like Black cultural centers that I was a member of in college who, you know, was like, oh, this is a really good author, you should read him. That was sort of one of my first introductions into, you know, sort of gay literature. I also read, you know, Oscar Wilde's plays. I really like The Importance of Being Earnest for some reason. But, you know, that sort of, I liked that genre, a play, you know, satirical, because it's the kind of things that I had been writing.
Yeah, that's another goofy farce.
Yeah, it's stuff that I was sort of drawn to. And, you know, I liked Dorian Gray as well. And, you know, I didn't get deeper into really reading, you know, like queer literature or anything, you know, probably until being even more of an adult then, you know, because I only came out the tail end of freshman year of college. And by then, you know, I was doing theater and, you know, reading plays in general. Wasn't necessarily looking for plays by gay authors. You know, I was watching series like Queer as Folk and Noah's Ark, you know, in my dorm room alone, like sort of being like, oh, what do gay people look like, you know, on TV or in movies? But, you know, I wasn't actively, I feel like, searching for them, at that moment, mostly because, you know, when I went to college, I was in a white environment for so long in high school that, I felt like college was more about me reading, Black literature and being, you know, becoming more socially conscious, and adjusting to being sort of a Black male in America, than focusing on also being a gay male in America, if that makes sense.
Right. So what did being gay look like to you? Like, what were you seeing on those shows, which are pretty different shows?
Yeah, mostly white people, I guess. Well, then there was Noah's Ark, which
right,
was an
yeah.
amusing show, but I wasn't as into it as Queer as Folk, probably just because Noah's Ark was comedy. And Queer as Folk was more dramatic and soapier, so it reminded me of the shows like Days and Passions that I watched when I was younger.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it really is a gaying up, as if that's possible, of the drama of the soap operas and just putting it in like a bunch of gay clubs and they're just taking different party drugs.
Yeah. So that was definitely why that show appealed to me. I was a big fan of Tony Kushner as well. So those were my introductions to gay writers. I feel like Baldwin, Kushner, and Oscar Wilde were the three that appealed to me in college the most, I guess.
That's quite a triumvirate. That's like, honestly, if somebody was like, oh, I want to like learn more about gay playwrights, I mean, you could not ask for a better like trio of people to recommend.
Yeah.
Can you describe, like, I think Tony Kushner might not be as household a name as the other two. Like, can you describe his work?
Tony Kushner's work is very cerebral, but also sort of uses magical realism a lot. He wrote Angels in America, which is the play that I feel like everyone is the most familiar with. Mm-hmm. But, you know, he also has A Bright Room Called Day. He has a play, Homebody Kabul. He wrote the musical Carolina Change. He also wrote the screenplays for Munich and Lincoln.
It seems, and you know, he seems like such a good fit for your interest in things that are slightly, like you mentioned, the magical realism of being a little fantastic, and I wouldn't say pulpy exactly, but there's a sense of like larger, more fantastic forces at work than you might initially be able to detect in the world around you.
Oh, of course. You know, I was, those were just the gay playwrights, but, you know, I was very into, Susan Laurie Parks, August Strindberg, Ionesco. I really liked absurdist theater, or, you know, that kind of, magical realism theater. August Wilson, a lot of his plays have, you know, magic or, you know, spells in them. So that's the kind of stuff that I was really drawn to.
Did you have particularly moving experiences in theaters, seeing productions of any of these shows?
I had a very moving time watching a production of Angels in America once that was done at school. I was a big Sondheim and musical fan. So, you know, seeing Sweeney Todd, seeing Company on Broadway, seeing Gypsy. These were very moving sort of moments for me.
They're dark. Those are dark shows.
Yeah.
What is it like? Do you just get like totally frustrated if you go to see like, well, I was about to say Carousel, but Carousel's probably their darkest show. Like if you just see like a really chipper upbeat musical, you're just like, this is boring. I need something more grim.
No, you know, and I'm not completely grim. You know, I mean, I can go see Anything Goes and have a great time. I can go see Wicked, you know.
Oh, yeah, nothing dark going on in Wicked.
Yeah, you know, but like, you know, I can see, you know, 42nd Street. I can see sure. Chipper. I just love musicals, you know, in general. I'm drawn to darker works. Yes, but love a good, thoroughly modern Millie, a Cole Porter.
So tell me about those, like, moving experiences. Like, when you went to see Angels in America, like, what was the, like, I think a lot of people have been fortunate to have that moment when you're in a theater where you're just, like, your breath's taken away by something. Is that how you felt when you saw that show?
I did, actually. You know, I thought it was a beautiful show, actually.
What was that production? So the first time I saw it was a student production when I was in college. And it was a bit ramshackle, let's say. And so it was very difficult to tell if they were, like, intentional decisions to make things look as though they were falling apart. And there's a particularly dramatic moment just at the very end that was almost completely destroyed by the sense of, like, is this supposed to be funny somehow because it's so falling apart? What did your experience look like? Like, what were you seeing up on stage?
I'm blanking completely on the year, but I saw we did one at Loyola, but there was also a professional production of Millennium Approaches. And, you know, even the school one, I felt like was very moving. We had great actors who did it. It was also a staged reading. So it was, no one was trying to do, you know, trying to do all the magic of the show and, like, you know, have, like, angels flying in on wings or anything. You know, it was just focusing on the words and the performance. And so
that's really where the power is.
And that's really all you need.
Yeah, yeah. Did you come out of that feeling changed in any way?
I came out of it feeling, you know, invigorated, you know, very excited and into playwriting. So, yes. I feel like probably.
Do you feel like, okay, I've got something I need to say?
Yeah, you know, I felt like when I started seeing shows like that, I started wanting to tell more about myself, tell more about the world around me, I suppose.
Yeah, well, I mean, you spoke about, like, the two shows that you were watching sort of compartmentalizing and having, like, here's the dramatic gay show, Queer as Folk, that's mostly about white people, and then there's Noah Arc over here that's more about the gay black male experience, but it sounds like you were sort of didn't have a lot of opportunities to have anything that reflected the fullness of who you are. Is that right?
Yeah, you know, not particularly. No.
What you mentioned, like, some of the shows that you're doing in New York, like the Harlem Renaissance, and then there was another one. It was about Vietnam. Is that right?
It was about it was like an absurdist Ionesco-ish play, so it was really not about any war in particular, but you can say Vietnam, Iraq, whichever.
What does it feel like to see something that you just put down on paper to suddenly see that come to life and to hear your words coming out of other people's mouths?
It's a beautiful feeling. Hard to describe. You know, it's, it's a moving experience. You know, it's different than, you know, a television or film thing. You know, seeing it live in theater is you know, still one of America's, still one of the world's, you know, most beautiful creations.
Were there particular messages that you were relieved to be able to get into the world, or just like shows that, like, as people are walking out, you're like, I hope that they're changed coming out of this?
I just always hope that people are entertained, and that people care about the people that I've written about. I don't particularly care about trying to get a message across. I like people to interpret things how they want. You know, I mean, as a cultural critic, there's frankly, there's nothing I hate more than artists who try to explain their own work. So I think many directors and writers would be better off if they refrained.
Well, for sure. Like, when there's an explanation of meaning within the piece itself, I think that's like a really unpleasant experience for people, because it's like, well, you know, obviously the piece should speak for itself. Did you, like, you've sort of been on both sides here, because you have been a cultural creator and also a cultural critic. So how does that change the criticism that you do to have been through this whole experience of, like, okay, the all the authorship that you've done?
You know, I feel like in a way it hasn't changed much. I mean, when I was playwriting in college, you know, we were writing critical essays about plays that we read. You know, I felt like to be an artist, you always have to have a critical mind about art and how it coexists with the world that we live in.
So I guess that tees you up pretty nicely for the kind of work that you're doing a lot of now that people know you for, commenting on, you know, on pop culture and what other people are putting out into the world. Do you still do a lot of the playwriting? Is that still a part of your life?
I have not actually written a new play in probably about four years. I put one up about 4 years ago in Los Angeles, but that was the last one that I've written. LA is sort of a hard theater town, and I just haven't really had the time that I feel like you need to devote to fully working on theater if you're going to produce it.
Do you miss it?
I do, actually. I miss it often.
Do you have, like, buzzing around in your head, like, oh, I want to do a play about this, or I want to do a play about something else?
Always. Every day.
What, like, if you could, like, what would your next play be about?
I don't know. You know, I'm covering a lot in Hollywood and our culture right now, and I think that a lot of the conversations people are having politically about sex and consent and our interactions with one another is ripe for writing, but, you know, I don't have anything particular in my mind at the moment. It's just always sort of feel a need to be putting something on the page.
So what got you out to Los Angeles?
Well, I went to grad school for screenwriting, so I moved to LA to do that.
And so the plan was to write for TV and film?
Yes.
Did you do any of that?
Well, I put up a play, so no. I was doing, you know, a lot of that writing on my own, you know, entering contests and things and getting pretty far in some of them. But, you know, ultimately I needed to, you know, pay my bills, and I had a desire for people to see my work and read it. And it was much easier for me to do that via the internet than it was to, you know, sort of chase a nebulous, possibly selling, you know, like a movie or something, you know? So I ended up with a job at BuzzFeed in 2014. And that sort of led me through, you know, realizing that I was able to find my voice as a cultural critic, able to find my voice as writing about pop culture, and found people who responded to it. And I guess that just, you know, it led me to working at New York Magazine, led me to MTV News, led me to GQ, and now it's led me to The Daily Beast. So, you know, I've been doing that nonstop since 2014. So,
I mean, it's really going back to what worked for you when you were in school, like that sort of quasi-gossip column where you're just like, okay, here's my thoughts, and people are like, yeah, tell us your thoughts.
Yes. The, you know, instant gratification of that is wonderful. You know, every writer craves that, I feel like.
What kind of feedback do you get? Like, that instant gratification? Like, how do people respond to the work that you do now?
Generally positively. You know, it sparks conversations with people. Or, you know, you find that other people sort of feel the same way. Or you find that you gave someone a new way of thinking about a piece of art. That the latter is always very satisfying.
What do you like writing about most?
You know, I used to like writing about television a lot. And I did that before I joined the Daily Beast. But now I've been writing about film a lot more. And I find that I probably enjoy that a bit more now.
Why is that?
You know, it's a finished product. So, you know, it's easier to comment on something that's not, you know, continuing weeks on. And your opinion of it might change rapidly.
Well, that must have been your experience, though, when you were watching soap operas, right? I mean, that's something that just goes on and on and on and on.
Of course. But also, most soap operas, if you stop watching and tune in 3 years later, the same thing will still be happening.
Sure. Sure, you could take a break from them.
Yes.
So in writing about movies, like, what are some movies that, like, were a particular pleasure to write about?
I loved writing about Moonlight and Call Me By Your Name. I've loved writing about Baby Driver this year, actually. I really enjoyed that movie. Mother.
When you're like writing about movies and evaluating them, like, is there some quality that you're looking for on the screen?
I'm looking for whether I'm entertained first, you know. That is the first way I know that I'm going to enjoy writing about a movie. And then I'm just looking for a movie to say something. And I don't mean say something in the sense that this needs to be serious, it needs gravitas, it needs to say something about humanity, you know, but I want to know that the people who created it for a reason. And even, you know, like a light, fluffy comedy, you know, can have that in it. You know, even Step Up, the movie, can have that in it. You know, there's some reason why someone made this product.
Well, you mentioned that, like, it annoys you when a creator explains the reason for something to exist. But it sounds like there's a pleasure in figuring that out on your own.
Of course. You know, and not always with the creator, but, you know, sometimes I just feel like some people can ruin their own work when they start talking about it if, you know, they see it in a way that other people don't, particularly, you know, if they see it as loftier or having some sort of better message than actually came across. It's better to just sort of stop digging that hole. You know, like, if you have to explain the movie for me to get it, you probably already lost. Your movie should say something.
I mean, is that how you feel about the writing that you do now? Do you feel like your writing has something to say?
Of course, otherwise I wouldn't be doing it.
So what are you saying?
I'm talking about our culture, and I'm talking about representations of race, representations of LGBTQ culture. I'm talking about, you know...
Well, I mean, like, so what about it? What about race and representation of LGBTQ culture? Like, do you want people to see in your writing?
Well, I don't want... The point isn't for people to see that in my writing. The point is for me to interpret that in other people's writing. I don't have anything to say unless I'm commenting on what's being put into the culture.
Yeah, so, I mean, what's your comment? Like, do you come to it with...
I mean, give me something to comment on, you know? I mean, like, I could have something different to say about what I feel like Moonlight puts into the culture versus what I think, you know, Call Me By Your Name puts into the culture. You know, I'm just interpreting what I feel like people are saying and what that says about our lives. But I don't interject how I feel I'm trying to understand that, you know, you're saying, like, what am I trying to say? I'm not trying to say anything. I'm trying to find out what art is saying.
So is this like a very reactive approach to culture?
Yes. Well, my criticism is vastly different from my playwriting. Playwriting is me being an artist and writing, you know, a piece where I'm obviously trying to get something across. It's different from me critiquing a piece of art.
So that's what I'm trying to sort of get a feel for, is like the difference between the criticism and the creative writing. That one is really reactive to what's going on the screen or in the work or whatever. And the other, you're inviting people in to be like, hey, everybody, listen to me.
Yeah, I mean, that's basically it.
Do you think that there would ever be a time where you want your criticism, like, to have more of a, I don't know, I hesitate to use the word agenda because it's that's such a loaded term, but that you would have, like, sort of a mission or perspective with the criticism that you're doing?
I mean, my mission is to always push forward positive conversations. You know, if I'm writing about Black LGBT culture, I'm writing about with the intent of giving humanity to something that often is not represented in the media or in our society or in our politics.
So you're looking for voices or stories that haven't had a voice before. You're looking for opportunities to elevate them.
At times, yes.
Well, I mean, then it makes sense that like a movie like Moonlight would have been a highlight.
Yes.
And that's also like the approach that you were taking with your playwriting. So maybe they're not all that different.
Sure, but with my playwriting, I'm elevating my voice and usually writing, you know, something based on my life or a story that interests me. And I'm telling a story with characters, which, you know, is a bit different from critiquing a film.
Mm-hmm. And I'm sure, like, your voice is still in there, like, when you're writing criticism.
Well, yes, absolutely.
Have you had, like, feedback from people whose work you've written about?
I have. People have reached out to me when they've really enjoyed something that I've written, you know, that I may have found something that they were thinking about when they made it and were interested to see that I saw that as well.
Do you find yourself getting starstruck ever?
By Oprah, maybe. Who I haven't met. But for the most part, no, I try and not be... I mean, I feel like there's probably a handful of people who I could be rendered speechless if I'm in their presence or if they were to reach out to me for... But for the most part, you know, I just try to do it like a job and sort of turn off that, you know, part of my personality, I would suppose.
Do you find yourself looking for those, like, characters that were appealing to you from the soap operas, like those really intense villainesses?
Always. You know, I always enjoy those types of characters. When I find pieces that have characters like that, I probably respond to them a bit more energetically. I'm more excited to watch them, I guess.
What's been a recent villainous character that you've gotten really excited about?
The Phantom Thread has such a character.
I don't think I'm familiar with that.
The latest Paul Thomas Anderson film?
Yeah, no, I'm not familiar. Wait, no, not the...
Starring Daniel Day-Lewis, the newest one about the dressmaker.
Okay, yeah, no, there was one that he did about an island of dogs, but no, I get my Paul Andersons mixed up. That's the other one, right?
Yeah, this one's the one who did Boogie Nights, the one who did The Master, There Will Be Blood.
These movies are all a little, well, I guess, depressing for me. So, like, they're not really stories that I seek out.
Okay, fair.
Like, I guess I need a little more 42nd Street and a little less Sweeney Todd. But so tell me about the villainesses, because it sounds like I'm actually missing something that I enjoy.
I don't want to ruin it too much, but there's a, you know, it's about a dressmaker and his sort of domineering relationship with a young woman that he brings into his fold. And there's more than meets the eye with her.
Well, so if people want to find your writing and read more of your criticism or, like, your plays, is there anywhere that they can find that stuff?
Not anywhere where people can find my plays at the moment, although maybe if you looked hard enough, if someone wants to Nancy Drew that. But none of them are readily available at the moment. But you can find my other writing at Ira on Twitter, and of course I'm at The Daily Beast, and talk about culture every week on my podcast Keep It, and I have some fun interviews with creators, musicians, writers, directors, producers, etc. You know, just I love finding out people's stories, and that's it.
Well, perfect. Well, Ira, thanks so much for joining me.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Thanks again to Ira for joining me and for pointing me in the direction of some deliciously dumb soap opera scenes. My recommendation this week is brief, just 30 seconds. It's a clip from an episode of Passions that you can find by searching YouTube for Teresa Chase's Gwen. The clip takes place at a particularly tangled moment in a ridiculous plot, and for some reason the show decided that what was needed was for a character to suddenly and breathlessly recap the entire plot of the story arc while in the middle of a chase scene in one take and in under 20 seconds. The result is a hilarious tongue-twister monologue of schemes and double crosses so ludicrous in its delivery that, well, here, I'll just play the whole thing for you.
Gwen, she's after JT. She probably wants to get the proof that he has it. She and her mother sent the information to the tabloid revealing Ethan's true paternity before JT has a chance to show it to Ethan. But I've got to get the proof so Ethan will believe that I'm telling the truth, that Gwen was actually the one who betrayed him. Maybe Ethan will realize that everything I did because I love him.
I mean, come on. This poor actress having to fit an entire scene's worth of words into basically a single breath while sprinting across a set, it's just a masterpiece of clowning. The intensity of the music, the desperation of her voice, the dire circumstances, which even after watching the clip over a dozen times I still cannot comprehend, are all so perfectly serious and perfectly stupid. Thanks again for listening. Remember, the next Sewers of Paris livestream is Saturday, April 14th at 2 p.m. Pacific. The theme this time is animation. Head over to the Sewers of Paris Twitter feed and look for the pinned tweet with a link to the livestream. Visit sewersofparis.com for links to the stuff that we talked about and to become a part of the Sewers family by supporting the show for as little as a dollar a month. It's thanks to the support of patrons that the show can go on, not to mention the bonus episodes and live streams. Visit @SewersofParis on Twitter and Facebook. I post clips of the media from each episode and chat with listeners about the entertainment that changed your life. I love hearing from you, so please don't hesitate to be in touch. You can also write to sewerspodcast@gmail.com. And thanks to everyone who's reviewed the show on iTunes. The theme song for the show is Parisian by Kevin McLeod of Incompetech.com, licensed under Creative Commons by Attribution 3.0. And until next time, croissant.